From a very young age, I was quite self-determined. Much of it was arrogance, but some of it was carried over wisdom from obviously having been a yogi in past lives. I don't think I could have come to the path, which is with as much commitment as I came to it, and absorb it so fast and so completely without it being something that I already knew. I mean, this is self-evident. If we look around at people's lives, people are born with talents or with interests or with intense aversions, and we have no idea really where it comes from, unless you have the idea that each incarnation is just another chapter in the same book. Because we're born as babies, because our memories are obliterated by God's own reasoning. Swamiji once remarked, the way people torture themselves over the few mistakes we can remember in one lifetime, imagine what it would be like if we could remember all our lifetimes and had to worry about everything that we ever did, even back hundreds of years ago. In truth, we do, because they are samskaras, they're impressions on our consciousness, and they influence us in certain ways. People are born with fears or with courage in certain ways, and we're anxious about many different things. I was very anxious from the earliest time I can remember that my life would be meaningless. Of course, when I was 5 years old, I didn't have the word meaningless really in my mind. But as far back as I can remember, it was always a deep anxiety that I would not find a high purpose, and that perhaps in finding that high purpose, I might fail in it. And sometimes insecurity manifests as arrogance. We try very hard to prove that we're not what we're most afraid that we are. I remember Swamiji talking to this one woman whom he counseled year after year. Her story is actually in the book, Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him, a book I published a few years ago. And she said, she honestly admits, I had to go to Swamiji. I don't know whether she put her name on the story, so I'm not going to say it. But she said, you know, month after month, year after year, she would go to Swamiji with essentially the same problems, just over and over again. And he would always treat her as if it was like a new reality. Let's talk about it again. Let's see where we can go. I don't think this is in her story, but on one occasion he said to her, you're spending all your energy trying to stave off the possibility that your worst fears are true. And it hasn't really worked very well. So I'm going to suggest an experiment. Let's assume that everything that you fear is true and that it's exactly as bad as you think it is. And so now, at least we don't have the tension of trying to stave off this possibility. Let's just try to build from the bottom, okay, like this. It didn't work, but it was a nice try. And she was good enough to be able to laugh about it later. But she talked about how his faith in her and his respect for her, because you see, it would be very easy if a person comes to you over and over again with the same essential problem, for you to dismiss it as unimportant. But he saw just the opposite. He saw the deep sincerity of someone trying very hard to do their best, but the weight of past lives was so heavy that it was very, very hard, and it took a long time for that karma to expiate itself. She describes Swami's love for her as like water, like a drop of water on a stone. It's just, it never stopped falling. You go to the Grand Canyon in America, that's the effect of water on stone. And this is the effect of the divine on all of us. It's water on stone. And you think that the water just doesn't have that much power. We listen to the beautiful song that Bhavani sang beautifully for us. with the wonderful guitar behind it. And a part of you can't think, why would you keep calling him if he never answers? How can you promise that even if he never responds, even for all eternity, I'm going to keep calling him? It seems like a bad deal, doesn't it? But this is what Swamiji is talking about. The intellect is endlessly ramified. It just goes in, it can and does go in all directions. Now, don't misunderstand. People then, therefore, think that the mind is unimportant and reason is unimportant and intellect should be put aside. Swamiji was never like that. Swamiji was the single most intelligent person I have ever met, the most widely read, the most highly educated, the most insightful in all the ways that mattered. I was raised in a very intellectual family. We liked words. Words were our trade. That was just the way we did things in the family. And when I met Swami Kriyananda in 1969, not very far from here over on the Stanford campus, he walked into the room and he brought with him a vibration of consciousness that I'd read about. Because at that point I had been introduced to Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda, and speaking of being a yogi in past lives, it may have had more dimensions to this, but my memory of it in now, at the age of 18, is I opened the book and I said, oh yeah, that's it, you know, this is it, this is what I've been looking for all this time. I took to it without hesitation. But I still only understood it from reading these books and from going to East West Bookstore, which was in Menlo Park at that time, because there was no internet, and the only way you could learn anything was from books. And thank God we had this extremely wonderful bookstore, which had imported all these books from India, and you could go and you could read, and I would just go there, and I read through the book about saints, and I read Catholic saints, and I read Tibetan saints, and I read Indian saints, and I knew that what they were describing was possible. I just intuitively knew it was true. And it was, the books I read were very intelligently presented, so it was satisfying on all of those levels. But they lived in ancient India, they lived in Tibetan caves, they were in Catholic monasteries, they were missionaries in the jungles, and I was just like, I was living in Palo Alto. It's like, I just didn't know how to do any of that. And I was Jewish, so I couldn't be Catholic. That was kind of a problem, you know? It was just all these different issues. And I knew it was there, but I couldn't figure it out. Even though my mind was exceedingly powerful and very active, I just couldn't figure it out. And then Swami walked into the room. I knew about him because friends had invited me. They had spoken highly of him. In fact, truer words were never spoken. My friend Lakshmi said to me, Lakshmi Selvi, not the Lakshmi who lives here. She said, I've met a true teacher and I think you'll like him. Yeah, that one turned out to be really an accurate prediction. He walked into the room and he brought a vibration of consciousness. That's the only way I can think to put it into words. He brought a vibration of consciousness that I knew in theory existed, but I had never experienced. But it resonated with me. And he didn't speak. He hadn't spoken, I should say. He hadn't spoken. He just walked in. And there was something in the room that I wanted. And wanted doesn't even begin to say it. I recognized it as what I had been seeking from as far back as my mind could go. And I have a few very early memories, very small memories, and that's what they were seeking. And then he spoke, and he gave a talk. I have no idea what he said. I really, to this day, cannot remember a word of it. But after he finished, I said, oh, that's the most intelligent man I've ever met. And I remember thinking, I didn't really have a deep devotion with God at the time, but I remember thinking, isn't that wonderful? Not only is it going to be spiritually inspiring, but it's going to be entertaining because he's so intelligent. So it's not that one precludes the other, and it's a profound mistake. But why was I so drawn? Because of the feeling in the heart. Let's call it love. I mean, I didn't say that I, you know, fell in love with Swami Kriyananda, but what is the power of love? The power of love is it compels us. It does not make action optional, right? You give birth to a baby, you have that baby in your arms. I've never in this life had children. I think I've had a lot of children in a lot of lives at different times. It's just, but you have that child, and people tell me instantly, your life means nothing compared to this child. What can you call that except love? You must act. When we think about things, we can act or not act. We can do it or not do it. But when feeling is involved, all of a sudden it becomes completely different. And on the spiritual path, where whether he replies or not, you have to keep calling him, there has to be something else going on. And by its definition, we can talk about it a lot, but sooner or later, it has to transcend, it has to move over. You know, all of us have been in love, maybe with a person or a puppy, or the feeling of what it is to create art, or the in love with beautiful ideas. But whatever it is, it moves us into another realm, and that's where real power is. They say in the scriptures, they speak of true intuition is calm feeling. It's a very interesting phrase, calm feeling. Because we think of feeling, because we don't have very good words in English. So we have to use words that have multiple interpretations and all these other kinds of meanings. Presumably in Sanskrit, there's exact words for these, but Swamiji never really compelled us to learn Sanskrit. I'm amused. I'm going to just digress into a completely irrelevant but entertaining story. There was this Swami Shankarananda. I presume he's still living. He's a disciple through Sri Ramakrishna, no, Sri Teshwar, of the same line of masters, but his lineage is different. He has the Kriya Yoga Temple in Rishikesh. For any of you who ever go there, beautiful round temple he has. I haven't been there or seen him in years, but he came to visit Swami Kriyananda, and because we're the closest international airport, we always get to be the vehicle, the conduit for people. So he arrived, and he's a sort of a portly Swami, and very, very fine man. And he might have stayed at our house. I can't really remember, but I drove him up to Ananda Village. He and I were in the car. Very traditional Swami in the way he looked and the way he behaved. And he starts talking to me about how Swami Kriyananda is truly a great master and so on, but he's been very, very deficit in that he hasn't taught us sufficient Sanskrit. And how can we possibly understand these ancient teachings unless we understand Sanskrit? And what can I say in defense of it? I'm an American kid. I know a few. I can say chakras, you know. I know a few words. But he's really lecturing me, and I just take it. There's nothing else I can say. He talks about the ancient traditions of India and how important this is. And then it was necessary for him to make a phone call, and I had a cell phone. But I had, for a very long time, until very recently, a little flip phone, right? Because I just didn't want the other one. So I hand him this. And with the same energy, he starts criticizing my telephone for being so out of date. And how can I just be so separated from the modern world? And how can I operate with this little phone? And I was able to tease him back. Ancient Sanskrit, but you're criticizing my telephone? You know, it's like, this world is just so entertaining, you know, and we're never consistent. We never are doing the same thing. We're always just going according to how we feel about things, isn't it? You know, we have this feeling and that feeling, and this is what we're doing. So it's vitally, and this is what this whole aspect of scripture is about. Here we have these Pharisees. And the Bible, unfortunately, posits Jesus against the Jews is how they put it in the Bible, which is a terrible way to put it, because Jesus was a Jew, and all of his people, almost everybody who was related to him was Jewish. It wasn't until after Jesus died and St. Paul, who couldn't get any traction in the synagogues because by then the Jews had divided into those who believed that Christ was the Messiah and those who didn't, and those who didn't had more power than those who did, so they started pushing all these now followers of what they believed to be the Messiah, which was Jesus. They started pushing them out. They were actually starving in Jerusalem. And it was St. Paul who said, well, these people are not listening to me. I'm going to go somewhere and find people who are. And so he went to the Gentiles, and he started, that's how Christianity became separate from Judaism, is that the Jews of the time weren't interested, and Paul found people who were. And eventually, the wealth of what Paul was doing saved the lives of the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem who had been marginalized by their own people. But in the Bible, they make it the Jews versus Jesus, but that's not true. It was the corrupt priesthood versus a new revelation. And the fact of what they called themselves really didn't make any difference. When you go to Israel and you're walking through the area, going to where the temple used to be, and they tell you about all the things they found. This was the richest part of town, and it was where all the priests lived. Surprise, surprise. And how did they have all that wealth and have all that power? Because they were telling people, this is what you have to do to be saved. This is exactly what you have to do to be saved. And Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple there, you have made of the house of our Lord, you have made it a marketplace, and he picks up a whip and he drives those people out. You know, when you, it's written as if we all knew what the context were, but you have to really understand the money changers. The temple had its own money. Now, this is how I understand it. I'm no scholar, but this is how I understand it. The temple had its own money, and in order for you to participate in the life of the temple, you had to buy a lot of stuff. You had to buy little animals to sacrifice or whatever it was, everything you had to buy. But whatever coin you had didn't work in the temple. You had to exchange your coin for the temple coin. That was what the money changers, you know, have you ever thought, why were there money changers? Whose money were they changing? And what do you know? There was a little profit for the temple in every one of those exchanges. And so priests who aren't producing any goods or selling them are just finding a way. This is just human corruption. This has nothing to do with religion. And of course, how is it enforced? Well, this is the rule. This is what the rule means. This is the consequence of following it. This is the consequence of breaking it. How do we know that's true? Well, because I said so. I, the priest, said so. And you get scared. You don't know. So you try to make it work, and Jesus comes through. And he says, yeah, it matters, but not very much. And he brought in this power. And what gave people the courage to follow him? They felt it. It was very dangerous to follow him. All the apostles except for John met a very inglorious end, inglorious in the eyes of the world. Later on, to follow Jesus, you had to go be eaten by the lions. I mean, these are not things that people would just like normally wake up in the morning and say, oh, let me go be eaten by a lion today. You know, it's just not the way it works. What gives you the power to do that? Why would you ever do that? There has to be something so much bigger. And it has to be in the heart. And then, of course, reason follows feeling. I love. At the end of Jesus' life, as is apparently common according to the way Master describes it, Jesus knew things are going to get tough here. And we need, you know, I could carry a lot of you, but now we need to have a very strong group, strong remaining core of apostles who can stand against the tides that are going to come and try to wash you away. So he started making it hard. He said, eat my body and drink my blood. And we didn't have, you know, the wine and the bread and the Catholic Church to explain to us symbolically. He just said, eat my body and drink my blood. And in the Bible, among my favorite lines in the Bible, it says, after Jesus says this stuff, the disciples said one to another, "This is a hard teaching." Don't you love that? I just adore it. It would be like all of us out here eating bagels and someone says to another, "Eat my body, drink my blood." I think she's crazy. I think that there's a better temple down the street. And then it says, from that point, many walked with him no more. Isn't that beautiful poetry? Walked with him no more. They didn't just leave. They had been moving with him, and now they couldn't move like that. So Jesus says to Peter, now Peter is the big hero of the Bible. Peter's so powerful. Peter, the rock, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not stand against it. You know, it's Peter's the big hero of the Bible. But Jesus had to ask Peter what he was going to do. So you can tell there's a big story going on behind here. Why would Jesus even ask him? Had Peter's best friend just left? Had his wife left him? Had his mother, departed from the teachings? We don't have any of those stories. But there was something happening where Jesus said to Peter, "Will you too also leave me?" And Jesus wouldn't have whined, "Are you going to leave me?" No. He wouldn't have accused either. He would have just asked, "Well, Peter, what are you going to do?" And Peter didn't say, "Oh, I understand perfectly the symbolism of what you've said, my Lord. I've read in this and I've understood in that." And so he didn't say any of that. He said, "Where would I go?" Meaning, this is my life. This is who I am. This is not an idea in my head. This is every part of my being. I cannot separate myself from you. Where would I go? And that's when Jesus knew that Peter truly understood. A vibration of consciousness walks into the room, and we know that this is who I am. That's what the spiritual path is. It isn't that we follow all these rules. We're always wanting to get it organized. How much do I have to do of this? How much do I have to do of that? And Swami, I love the way he put it. As soon as you know what you have to do, what you have to do to get into heaven, you immediately start calculating, how much can I get away with and still get into heaven like this? As long as it's laid out in this neat way that the mind can grasp. A friend of mine, when he was six, he was in Catholic school, and he was a rowdy lad. He was a very rowdy lad. He was a rowdy man, but he turned it into creative, positive work. And so the nuns found it very hard to make him behave, so they told him that he needed to be a good boy because then he would have a bigger house in heaven. Can you imagine? He was delighted. He was absolutely delighted because he didn't want a bigger house in heaven, and therefore he didn't have to be good. So it had exactly the opposite effect, But that's a lot of times, in grown-up terms, what we're being told. But there's no feeling in it. It's just words. And we're trying to make ourselves safe. And we're trying to avoid having to do what we really have to do, which is to purify the heart and learn how to love. And not just be good, I don't know where this is written, not just be good, I think Master says it actually, not just to be good because it is our habit to be good. Good meaning in harmony with higher law, but to be in harmony with higher law because where else could I go, Lord? To become so deeply understanding and so in love with the divine power that at one point or another has touched our lives that we simply know I could not do anything else, that it is who I am. It's not how I behave. It's not what I believe. It's not what I'm afraid of. It's just simply who I am. This is who I am. I'm incapable of doing anything else now. And then, keep calling him. How can you stop? even if there's no reply, because this is who I am. Where would I go? That's what we're trying to do in the spiritual path, so that right out of our hearts, when somebody wakes you from a deep sleep, and you don't have any time to think, but you just respond, where else would I go? This is who I am.
Keep calling him, keep calling him, keep calling him. Whether he replies or not, keep calling him. In the temple of unceasing prayer, believe that he's approaching there, and call to him, keep calling him. Thou dost know I'm praying, Lord, you know I love no other. I'll speak not, nor ask when, to expect from you an answer. You know my heart. I'll call to thee again. Keep calling him. Keep calling him. Whether he replies or not, keep calling him. I'll wash thy feet of silence with the waters of my tears. The altar of my soul be empty till thou comest. I'll wait for thee. No matter days or years, keep calling him. Keep calling. Whether he replies or not, keep calling him. In the center of my heart, I have a mystic throne for thee. The candles of my joys are dimly burning now in hope, awaiting thy coming. Though it be eternity, keep calling him, keep calling him. Whether he replies or not, keep calling him. Even when there's no reply, never let your longing die, and call to him. Keep calling him. Remain persistent, undepressed, through dark and seeming silence. If in the midst of life, disease and death, you play the dancer, yet keep calling Him. You will receive His answer. Keep calling Him. Keep calling Him. Keep calling Him.
So silently and sweetly, the Master comes to me. His love and joy enfold me in bliss and ecstasy. My mind is calm and peaceful, all cares are swept away, and in His omnipresence I know that I am free. My mind is calm and peaceful, all cares are swept away, and in His omnipresence I know that I am free. So sweet the sound of home, His Master's voice I hear. In all-pervading silence, He whispers, I am near. My heart with joy is flowing, it sings eternally. There is no other love like the Master's love for me. My heart with joy is flowing, it sings eternally. There is no other love like the Master's love for me. There is no other love like the Master's love for me.